This is UN and Africa from the United Nations in New York. I'm Matthew Wells. In this week's programme, torture, rape and unlawful killings are now the norm in South Sudan, together with evidence of ethnic cleansing, says a new UN report. And we'll hear how musicians in northern Mali survived and then defied the rule of extremist militants. But first, hunger-related illnesses have killed 47 children over the past 2 months at just one government-run hospital in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. The UN's been warning the world of the dire consequences of drought in the Horn of Africa country, where nearly 3 million are at risk of famine. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres recently appealed for $825 million to support more than 5 million people over the next 6 months. Deanne Penn reports.
At the Banadir Hospital in Mogadishu, a doctor inserts a drip line into the arm of a small, thin child. At least 1,200 youngsters have been treated there for severe malnutrition over the past 2 months. 47 have died during the same period. Dr. Lul Mohamud Mohamed is head of the pediatric department.
The most cases, the death cause is the dehydration. We are doing the rehydration of the child, and we're given also some antibiotics for that because it's acute watery diarrhea and suspect we have cholera. This is what we have done so far.
Severe drought has driven thousands of Somalis from their home villages and communities. People come to Banadir Hospital from as far away as the Bakool region in the southwest of the country, about 350 kilometers or more than 200 miles from the capital. Others are a little closer. They're sheltering in camps for displaced people located around Mogadishu. Jili Abukar arrived at the hospital with her grandson.
Thank God, since we got here, his situation is improving and slowly getting better. He was put on a drip and is also receiving medication.
The large number of critically malnourished children being admitted to the hospital is overwhelming, according to the UN mission in Somalia, UNSOM. It's an indication of the severity of the drought, which the UN fears will degenerate into famine if the international community fails to act swiftly.
Ask you please, where did you come from?
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres traveled to Somalia earlier this month, his first field mission since taking office in January. He was accompanied by UN Humanitarian Coordinator Stephen O'Brien, who briefed the Security Council when he returned to New York.
What I saw and heard during my visit to Somalia was distressing. Women and children walk for weeks in search of food and water. They have lost their livestock, water sources have dried up, and they have nothing left to survive on. With everything lost, women, boys, girls and men now move to urban centres.
The UN is seeking more than $800 million to address the needs in Somalia. But the country is not alone in this crisis. Yemen and South Sudan, as well as northeast Nigeria, are also living under the threat of famine. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
Torture, rape, unlawful killings, arrests and detentions have become the norm in South Sudan as the human rights situation continues to deteriorate. That's the stark conclusion of a report by the UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan, presented to the Human Rights Council in Geneva on Tuesday. The world's youngest country has been mired in conflict since 2013 between rival factions, which has left hundreds of thousands dead and millions displaced. The commission was appointed last June to report on the human rights situation and make recommendations for improvements. Team leader Yasmin Suka told Nelson Luak that ethnic cleansing was definitely underway in parts of the country.
One of the problems in South Sudan is the entrenched impunity. And so you cannot argue that you need peace first without justice. Peace and justice are the two sides of the same coin, and they reinforce each other. And without justice, you will never have sustainable peace. And for that reason, the implementation of the peace agreement with the governance and security arrangements in Chapter 1 and Chapter 2, as well as the Chapter 5 arrangements around justice and accountability, these must be implemented without delay.
Yes. Now, what are your general impressions of the human rights climate in South Sudan?
It's deteriorating. 6 months of monitoring. In our view, the situation is deteriorating. We're also alarmed by the way in which the incidence of human rights violations and abuses are on the increase. concerned by the fact that this is ethnically targeted, and we're very clear that ethnic cleansing is underway, particularly in the Equatorial.
And what must be done to improve respect of human rights in South Sudan now?
Well, you know, obviously education is important, and I think that unless and many of the human rights groupings actually carry out that education, but, you know, the human rights violations can be directly attributed to conflict, and so it's important that the conflict ends. But secondly, those who are responsible for perpetrating those violations must be held accountable. You know, impunity flourishes when the perpetrators know that they can get away with it. And my impression of what is going on in South Sudan is that the perpetrators perpetrate these violations knowing full well that they will never be held accountable because no mechanism exists at present to hold them accountable. If you know that you will one day have to appear before some kind of authority to answer for the crimes you have committed, that's a deterrent. And in this context, no such deterrent exists.
Now that the report with recommendations have been presented to Human Rights Council, what next? What should the people of South Sudan expect?
What I know from what is happening is that member states, the government of South Sudan, really they're going to have to decide what happens next.
Making a documentary about the conflict in Mali was inherently risky, but those risks were nothing compared to those facing the people living there, according to one filmmaker. Johanna Schwartz is the director of the documentary They Will Have to Kill Us First, a film about musicians in Mali after Islamist groups took over the northern part of the country and banned music in 2012. All-out conflict between the Malian government and armed militants supporting it and northern insurgent groups lasted until 2015, when a fragile UN-backed peace agreement was signed. Following a screening of the film at UN headquarters last week, Isabelle Dupuis spoke to Ms. Schwartz about the risks and rewards of making the documentary.
But I arrived and really the conflict was still so fresh. Everyone was still all over the place. So I literally started filming the first day that I got there. And I was taken to the home of Hira Arbi, who is the Nightingale of the North. She's a beloved singer in Mali and indeed around the world. And she sang for us that first morning that I was in Mali. And really, it was at that moment that I thought, 100% definitely need to tell this story. And I think that through the story of the musicians, you can get a much better picture of what's going on in Mali. Had I just sort of decided to make a film about the conflict itself. I mean, really, it's through the story of the musicians that I think people can truly understand what went on there.
And how did the shooting go? What were some of the risks? Because it seems like such a volatile, dangerous, I mean, situation, and also the musicians must have also had to go through risks to accept being part of your project.
We were under a certain amount of risk, the film crew, but it was nothing compared to the risk that everyone around us was under in Mali. I mean, if things got a bit hairy, you know, we could get on an airplane and go home, and nobody else could do that. So even though there were risks that we were undertaking, in comparison and in perspective, it felt like they were risks that were important to take. There were moments that were scarier than others, but I have to say that the UN office in Mali were instrumental, and we 100% couldn't have finished the film, you know, if it wasn't for their help, and they really did help on the security side.
Could you maybe tell us about some of the musicians you featured in your film, and especially this group, the Songhoi Blues?
We were extraordinarily lucky. So on the very first day that we were there, we met Hira Arbi, and that was the first filming trip. The second filming trip, we met a wonderful singer called Fadimata Walet Umar, nicknamed Disco. She's from a very traditional Tuareg band called Tartit. On the third filming trip, we met a musician called Musa, who is sort of a jobbing guitarist, plays a lot of weddings, been in a lot of different bands. He's like a session guitarist, and he was a wonderful character. He brought a really interesting element, actually, to the film. And then on the fourth filming trip, we met Songhoi Blues. And it was when I met Songhoi Blues that I realized that I was done looking. And I had four different characters who really would be able to convey the story of what was happening in Mali in the right way. Everyone came at it from a very different perspective. It's important that you find characters that have different perspectives on what was happening.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of UN and Africa. You can follow more of our programs at radio.un.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Matthew Wells.